welcome to Catholic Answers Live, and more importantly, Merry Christmas to you as we continue with our Christmas season programming. And we're just so grateful that you would join us during this Christmas season. Anybody who's joining us maybe for the first time, because you don't usually get the opportunity to tune in at this time of day, welcome. We're delighted to have you. Catholic Answers provides this program, makes this program, and if you want to find out more about the apostolate Catholic Answers, you can just visit us at Catholic.com. That's not hard to remember, Catholic.com. I don't know why we did it, but we waited until the second to last day of the year to do my favorite show of the year. We haven't even done it yet, and I'm already convinced this is my favorite show of the year. Our good friend Steve Weidenkopf, who's a lecturer in history at Christendom College Graduate School of Theology in Alexandria, has a brand new book out. As a matter of fact, Christmas Day was its release date, and the book is called The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. It's about the years between the year 1000 and the year 1378. First of all, Steve Weidenkopf, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Si. Thanks for having me on the show again. Glad to be here, and Merry Christmas to you.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to you. Thank you. I am convinced that the entire modern history of the world involves a giant act of propaganda. And that act of propaganda goes like this. The Middle Ages was backwards, dark, dingy, and horrible. And then a new light dawned, and we got the modern world. Is that a massive over... Well, I guess everything's a massive oversimplification. But how far off am I with that?
No, I don't think you're too far off on that, Si, really. I mean, that is pretty true. I mean, you know, and I cover that sentiment in the book. I mean, that really is what people think of the Middle Ages or the word medieval. I mean, that's the immediate, mental picture that people get. You know, dark, brutish, bloody, violent, full of, you know, religious zealots or superstitions and things like that. And that's pretty much how that time period is usually portrayed in the media and Hollywood and things like that as well.
Steve is the author of a whole bunch of books, including Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church, The Real Story of Catholic History. He has a book on the Reformation, a 20 Answers booklet with us on the Reformation. He wrote The Glory of the Crusades. He wrote Epic, A Journey Through Church History. And now we have the new book, The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. And this is why I say this is one of my favorite, I know this is going to be one of my favorite shows of the year, is that I think one of the things that would help people in the modern world is a more honest telling of history. We'd know our place in the world better if we had a more honest telling of history. I assume, looking at your list of books, that you would agree with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I've dedicated a bit of, you know, my work and my focus of my work on trying to do that, right, to present an authentic understanding of history of these, you know, previous centuries in a way that is accessible to people. So it's not just, for academics or whatnot, but for more popular, wider audience. And in a way that really, again, gets back to what I think is the emphasis the original kind of focus of history, which is the telling of stories, right? Narrative approach, which doesn't mean that obviously what you're telling is not true, like it's made up or fiction or something. That's not what I mean by story or narrative, but that's really what, you know, presenting history as the human drama it is, right? Full of heroes and villains and you know, although complex people, as Catholics, we understand, right, that everyone is a fallen yet redeemed creature and given free will. And sometimes, you know, people act in accordance with virtue and in accordance with their calling and their vocation, and sometimes they don't. And even at the highest levels of the church, for example. So, and as a Catholic historian in particular, we don't want to shy away from that. We're not presenting some kind of whitewashed, picture-perfect presentation of the church's history. You have to present it warts and all, but you explain it in the context in which the people lived, and that's what I tried to do really in this recent book, in an age, as we talked about, that is so easily misunderstood and mischaracterized.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, because what you just said, in part, Steve, because I imagine I'm probably guilty of this sometimes. The tendency is to say modern historians, and not even just modern historians, but modern storytellers, people who make movies and television shows and write novels and that kind of thing, are so unfair to the people of the Middle Ages, particularly, the Christian people, let's be honest, the Christian people of the Middle Ages, that you want to just defend them. And but if you do that in a way that doesn't admit, yeah, there was a lot of the shady stuff that went on there, then you're really you're committing the same act just in reverse, kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's one thing I talk about in the book, too, is just, you know, I think one of the reasons why people in the modern world tend to struggle with this period of time is one way or one reason is because of the way it's been taught and in you know, in our educational environment is one thing, but and presented, as we've talked about, in the media and Hollywood, but also because you know, our modern world is so significantly different from the world of the medieval period, right, of the Middle Ages. In terms of what I mean by that is it's really two different things that that we in the modern world struggle with, right? The medieval world or the medieval worldview was very hierarchical, right? Medieval society was hierarchical, it was authoritative, right? Democracy as a political institution and as a bedrock of a society or of a nation, mm-hmm. like we have in the United States, just didn't exist. You know, there was a hierarchy, and people understood that hierarchy, and they kind of accepted that hierarchy, if you will. It was enforced by societal norms and values, and it imbued every area of life, especially politically, except for, interestingly enough, the church. Right, the church was the one area of medieval life where someone could advance regardless of who they were and where they came from, and that was not true of secular society. Right, if you were born a serf. You know, you were the son of a serf. Very rare would you ever amount to anything more than that in medieval society, unless you entered the church. And if you entered the church as a son of a serf, but you were, you know, you were smart, you were, you know, you dedicated your life to service and to living a, you know, a holy life, you could advance. You know, up to you could be an abbot, you could be a bishop, you could even, you know, get to the highest levels of the church's office. So there's that. And then the other aspect is just what we've been talking about, the faith aspect of the Middle Ages, right? Modern man has such a difficulty understanding that that one's life would be so infused with the faith, you know, from the time you woke up to the time you, you went to bed, that's what medieval man, you know, that's what the medieval world was about. It was imbued with the Catholic faith, and we just don't really appreciate that as much, or if at all, in the modern world, frankly.
We're talking about the Middle Ages this hour, and the occasion for this conversation, one that I have been looking forward to, is the publication of the new book, The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. The author is Steve Weidenkopf. You can find all about Steve at his website, steveweidenkopf.com. Steve, as I said earlier, is a lecturer in church history at Christendom College Graduate School of Theology in Alexandria, Virginia. We probably should take a quick break, but one of the things you focus on in the book is misconceptions about this period of history. Can we do some major misconceptions when we come back, Steve?
Absolutely. We'd love to.
All right. Let's do that. We'll focus on some misconceptions about the Middle Ages with Steve Weidenkopf right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Don't forget to check out the latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus. You can listen each week to the world's premier podcast on Catholic apologetics at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Catholic Answers Focus, now available at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
She is one of the most beloved saints of all time. Honored as the saint of the little way.
Matthew Bunsen and the doctors of the church.
St. Thérèse of Lisieux entered the Carmelite convent of Lisieux in 1888 and survived only 9 more years. Still, her extraordinary holiness and prayer life prompted her superiors to have her write an autobiography, The Story of a Soul. It became a spiritual classic.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for being with us. Steve Weidenkopf is our guest. He's got a brand new book. He's got a whole bunch of great history books, but you can just check out his section at Amazon to see. But he's got a brand new one now. It just came out this week, The Church in the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. We said before we went to the break, Steve, we'll take a look at some misconceptions about this period of history. Before we look at the misconceptions, I noticed the dates on your book are 1000 to 1378. I usually think of the Middle Ages as longer than that. This is like the middle of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, exactly, Si. I mean, it's, you know, that, and that's a debate even within the own academic community about what, what really are the Middle Ages and how do you, what years do you define them? Generally, there's some acceptance, you know, 500 to 1500 kind of around there, although that's a massively unwieldy amount of time. But yeah, but this age, in my book, I guess one would consider like the High Middle Ages. That would be the more sub, you know, greater subdivision of the time period, if you will.
And so after – why 1378? What happens in – or did you just get tired and you stopped writing there? Or I assume there's something that happened in 1378 and you said, that's it, a plague on the rest of this. I'll just go from there.
Yeah, that's a great question. I had the, I had my 14th century dartboard up, and I just, you know, threw the dart and it landed on 1378. No, I stopped it there. Well, so first of all, I should say, right, that this book is one in a series that Ave Maria Press is doing on reclaiming Catholic history. So there's seven volumes, and obviously I couldn't, you know, cover all of it. I had to cover a specific period of time, but I chose 1378 specifically for this to end because that's when you have the end of the Avignon Papacy. That's the time period when we had the popes actually living in Avignon in the south of France. They were not resident in Rome anymore. They were still the Bishop of Rome, just not living there. So it's in 1378, principally through the actions of St. Catherine of Siena, that they return to Rome. And then more bad things follow actually after that. But I had to end the story somewhere. And I figured, you know, coming back to Rome and ending this century, the 14th century, which was really a crisis in the papacy itself with the Avignon Papacy and other things that followed and all kinds of ecclesiastical abuses going on at the time in the church, that was a good marker to just kind of end the story and let the next author pick up from there.
And by you invoke the term the High Middle Ages, that does give us a sense really of the truth about this period, which is it's a very high period of culture. And there does come some decline after that. But this is a very high period for culture in Europe.
Yeah, very true. I mean, this is, you know, you begin to see, especially towards the end of this period in the 14th century, the kind of, you know, initial, you know, proto-Italian Renaissance type of artists, you know, Giotto and people like that, that are alive and doing some fascinating artistic things with frescoes and other, you know, medium, in especially in Italy. But even more so, you know, in other parts of Europe, of Christendom, especially in France, this is the period of the Gothic cathedrals, right? Or as some architectural historians might refer to it as the French style rather than Gothic, because Gothic was a kind of a negative connotation associated with it or given to it. But yeah, you know, these massively large cathedrals, which we still see today, which we still cherish today, you know, the Cathedral of Notre Dame, the Cathedral at Chartres, you know, all these other various magnificent structures built for the glory of God, you know, were really the cultural and artistic achievement of this time period, that's for sure.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the misconceptions about this period, about the Middle Ages. You picked out nine of them for the book, but what would you like to share with people? Major misconceptions about what was going on during this period.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one that comes to mind easily, and it's the first one I address actually in the book, is were serfs slaves? You know, what's the distinction between a serf and a slave? Many people, when they hear serfs or peasants, they really have this sense of, you know, these were individuals who were really no better than slaves, right? I mean, it was kind of a status that was, slavery, it, you know, that we akin to like what slavery was like in the 19th century or something like that, especially in the United States. But when you look at the serfs, you know, and these group of people in the Middle Ages, that's not true at all. They were, as I mentioned, medieval society was very class-oriented, class-stratified. It was very hierarchical. And you had people at the bottom of medieval society, if you will, that were peasants, serfs, as we would call them as well. But there's a distinction between them. There were non-free serfs and there were free serfs, right? There were non-free peasants and free peasants. So your status really wasn't determined on whether you were a peasant or not. It was, as being a peasant, were you free? Were you unfree? What do I mean by that? Well, when you were an unfree peasant or an unfree serf, what that meant was you had to farm land that was not your own. You had to take care of land that was not your own. You had to take care of the demesne, it was called, or the land that was owned by someone else, usually by a lord, right, by a nobleman. You were also given a small plot of your own land to be able to serve or farm and to provide for your family from. And that small piece of land that you had was actually yours. And so unlike slaves, serfs actually, even unfree serfs, actually owned property. They owned their own land. And that land could be then given to their heirs, right? So, the father dies, he could hand on that land to any sons that he had so that they could provide for themselves and keep that land, so to speak, in the family. Free serfs or free peasants were different, right? They can farm their own land. They didn't have to spend any of their time farming the land of lords or noblemen, and they could do other things as well. They could have other, vocations as we would see them. They could, be a blacksmith or come, some kind of trade or whatnot. So serfs, had a right to a family as well. As I mentioned, they could pass property on to their family, and they even had, times of great rest. Medieval society was organized and structured by the church's liturgical year. And so on solemnities and great feast days, especially, local saints or regional saints, you would have the day off from labor. So, one historian has estimated that, of the 365 days in a year, medieval serfs had about 100 days off from work because of the church's liturgical calendar and her feast days. So that's a very great distinction of these people from what we know and what we understand as modern day slavery or more recent slavery.
So then what would they do on these feast days? Like, was it pleasant? I mean, they have fairs and things, or was it all in church?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, there were big parties, usually big festivals associated with these, with feast days. So, yeah, I mean, obviously the main event, if you will, would be the liturgy, attending mass, at the local, at your church or even at the cathedral if you lived close near one, and celebrate mass for that saint's day. And then afterwards there would be games and parties and lots of different food. And, you might have some traveling minstrels come to town or, some comic troupes or other kinds of entertainers, if you will. And it would be a time of just great relaxation, rest, and fun.
So that it does sound humane, there's a lot of people today that would like to have 100 days off a year. I mean, people work themselves to the bone in the modern world, but think of medieval people as living in a much harsher work environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, people, serfs, peasants, they did work, backbreaking work. So, it was heavy labor. It was agricultural work. Obviously you had animals who could help you with that kind of work as well. But yeah, it was difficult work. Not like us sitting at desks, with computers and things like that, as many people do today. So, but yeah, it was hard. But so when you had those days off, that was, that was definitely a way in which you could understand rest, right? Because you didn't have to have that hard work. You could spend time with your family. You could do things with the kid. The kids didn't have to work. Your wife didn't have to work as hard either, kind of thing. And so it was a time for more family environment and family events as well.
So what other misconceptions do we have about this period?
Well, you know, another one that I cover in this book, but I also cover it in the book that I wrote on the Crusades, is about the Crusades and why were Crusaders motivated to go on these armed expeditions, on these armed pilgrimages? And one of the major myths that people believe about the Crusades, which you still see and hear all the time in the modern world, is that they went because of land. They went because of money, because of greed. There was this old myth that was taught in academics, or I even learned it as an undergraduate, frankly, that the myth that there were, in this period of time in Europe, especially in the 11th century, you had this huge population growth. That part is true. Actually, there was a big population growth in the 11th century. But the myth then would taught that because you had so many people, and you had families had second, third, and fourth born sons, that and because of the rights of property and the you know, distribution of property and the whole rise of primogeniture, or the policy, if you will, that the oldest son or one son gets all the land in a family, that you had these second, third, and fourth born sons running around Europe without land, trying to get land, and so they were fighting each other. And it was causing all kinds of war and violence in European society. And so the church decided to take all these second, third, and fourth born sons and send them, you know, across the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. to the east to go fight Islam, to go fight Muslims and take their land. And that's one of the major myths about the Crusades and why people are motivated. And like I said, it still continues to be a very popular understanding of the Crusades. But when you begin to look at the research of this and pull it back, pull the onion back, so to speak, you see that especially in the First Crusade, the ones who went on Crusade were not second, third, and fourth born sons, but rather first born sons who went. The ones who, in a certain sense, stood to lose the most by going on Crusade went. And why was that? Well, it's because families, especially French families, knew that what the Pope had asked them to do, to travel to the Holy Land, to liberate Jerusalem, especially the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, from Islamic control, was such a unique opportunity, such a unique and important call, that the most important person in the family, the firstborn son, was the one that had to go. And that's what happened. And not only that, they were motivated not by land and wealth, because it was a pilgrimage. What they saw they were doing was going on a pilgrimage. And just like you and I go on a pilgrimage to Rome or other shrines or places, Jerusalem even today, we go, we pray at the shrine, and we come home. And that's what they did. The vast majority of Crusaders who lived, especially on the First Crusade, went to Jerusalem. Those who remained or who lived through the event, most of them went home after they had liberated the holy city of Jerusalem. They didn't stay. Some did, but most of the vast majority who were still alive went home because it was a pilgrimage. And they went because of the spiritual privilege that they were granted by the Pope, the indulgence. And so there was a huge motivational or spiritual motivation behind why they did what they did that's usually not addressed in most modern understandings or tellings of the Crusades.
It's hard for us to understand, though. We don't live in that kind of an age, and so maybe we're cynical about it. Oh, they claim that they were concerned with their eternal salvation, but come on, there was money to be made. Do you see that? Like, we just don't think like they thought.
No, we don't. And that's the big, one of my favorite writers and historian, popular historians is Hilaire Belloc, right? The English, who's a politician, author, historian, died in the mid-1950s. But he talks about what you just described as kind of, reading backwards into history, right? The past or the modern day kind of seeing itself in a position of superiority to the past. That we know better than the people who lived before us, right? Of course there was money that they were looking to get. We tend to view past historical events through our own lens and through our worldview, and we apply that backwards. And that's reading backwards into history, and that's inappropriate. I mean, the job of the historian really is to understand the period authentically from the perspective of those who lived in it, and then to present that to people in his or her own day and age. And so the best way to understand history is, again, to see it from that contemporary perspective. And that's like, as you mentioned, that's why a lot of people struggle with understanding the Crusades, or why people would be motivated to do these things from a faith perspective, because that's not how we are motivated mostly, right, in the modern world.
No, we're right. That's not, that's one that's unfamiliar to us, to live in a place where You know, even if you're a believer in the modern world, you're a believer amidst a prevalent kind of unbelief. Whereas if you were an unbeliever, I suppose, in the Middle Ages, you would have been an unbeliever amidst a prevalent atmosphere of belief. Everything pointed towards God and towards Christ. Steve, this is what I was attempting to get at, was the idea that it's hard for us because we, even a believer lives in a time, a believer today lives in a time of unbelief. And so that it's hard for us to imagine a time of belief where just everybody, everywhere was believing in the things that that happened in the Bible. They believed in the promises of Christ. They believed in eternal life. These were real things for them. Well, we better take a break. We'll come back and pick it up right there when we come back, because I can hear the music. We're talking about the Middle Ages with Steve Weidenkopf, the author of a brand new book on the Middle Ages. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Dale Alquist of the American Chesterton Society, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
In what forms does the Word of God come to us? How do we know that the Bible is inspired, inerrant, and complete? Why do we need tradition to help us understand Scripture? Doesn't the Bible teach that it alone is sufficient for salvation? In 20 Answers, Scripture and Tradition, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, examining the first and most important issue in the Christian faith, the manner in which God has communicated to us the saving truths of the gospel. 20 Answers, Scripture and Tradition is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and a very Merry Christmas to you and to all of yours. We're talking about the church in the Middle Ages because there's a brand new book out from Steve Weidenkopf called The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and wait, what's the third part of it? Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. That's it, the Papacy in Exile. Steve Weidenkopf is lecturer in church history at Christendom College Graduate School of Theology in Alexandria, Virginia, and the author of many other fun and engaging history books. I say that because I know that a lot of people think history books are not fun and engaging because the modern way of telling history it can be kind of dull. Not Steve. He tells stories and helps you understand and get into the mindset of the people of that time. That's what kind of where we left off before the break, and a little bit of a technical hiccup. But I want to go back to the question that I was asking you, Steve, which is that even a believer today is at a disadvantage trying to understand the medieval person, because even a believer grows up in a world in which unbelief, or at least a kind of secular agnosticism, is the norm. And so we can't imagine, or I shouldn't say we can't, but it takes great effort for us to imagine and do justice to just how pervasive faith in Christ and his promises were in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, that's exactly true, Si. I mean, it's. I think you summed that up very well in terms of, you know, how we are living in a world that even believers, right, Catholics or others who have a deep faith life, you know, are living really in a sea of, you know, secular agnosticism or secular humanism, and it's difficult for us. And like you said, it takes great effort even for believers to kind of transport ourselves back into the minds of those and lives of those who lived before us, especially in the centuries in which I cover in this book, but I think that with that, right, that there's also a benefit to our belief from that perspective in terms of history. In that, what I mean by that is that I think a Catholic is unique, a modern day Catholic, even in a world where we struggle with the general, you know, sense of the world or the general disbelief of the world. We though have I think an easier time maybe, or a greater ability to understand the perspective of those who came before us, and answering some of these questions and looking at some of these historical events which modern day people struggle with, frankly. You know, we talked about the Crusades before the break briefly. I mean, that's exactly the point is that, you know, we as believers can understand why a nobleman or, you know, a warrior of some sort, an archer or a spearman, might decide he wants to take the vow and go on crusade, principally because he can receive an indulgence, a plenary indulgence, because we know what those are. We know what that doctrine means. We know what benefit that provides for our souls. And so when we read that and we say, oh, that's why they went, yes, we can kind of get that more so than someone who's not. And I don't mean to say that historians or others who aren't of faith can't understand, you know, the spiritual motivation of those in this time period that we're talking about. You can, and many do, and there are many fantastic secular or non-Catholic, non-Christian historians of the Crusades that do get that. But there's a little more effort, a little more work involved in trying to figure that out. And still, I think it even presents a bit of a conundrum for people in that, you know, wow, I can maybe understand why they would do that, but that's something I could never do. And so you lose a little bit of association with those before us.
I'm just going to throw out another. I want you to settle this for me, whether this is a misconception. If I'm walking down the street in any medieval town or city, pretty much every day I'm going to run into them burning heretics. It's probably the stench of burning heretics. It just never goes away in the ancient world. And this was a terrible evil of medieval society, this persecution of free thinkers. What would you say to that? Am I pretty much – I think I'm getting it all right. Am I getting it all right?
Yeah, no, I would say you're getting it mostly wrong, frankly. Yeah.
All right, Steve Weidenkopf.
Yeah. No, but that is, I mean, what you say there is what many people think, right? Yeah, obviously, yeah. There's you know, all kinds of bonfires of witches, or, you know, trying to see if people float, and all these other kinds of things that is happening in the Middle Ages, and you know, that's just not true. I mean, you know, again, it you have to look at we tend to see it, and because we talk about the term, we even use the Middle Ages, right? Is a very kind of, you know, generic, amorphous term, and you know, just like today, same was true in the medieval period. Rather, there were regional differences, mm-hmm. you know, in throughout Christendom and throughout European society at the time. So, you know, whereas there might be, you know, the presence of medieval inquisitors, papally appointed inquisitors in the south of France, for example, during the 12th century, that. You know, doesn't mean that was applicable everywhere throughout Christendom, right? So that's one false notion that we really have to, you know, disavow ourselves of, is taking something that may have happened in one area or one regional, you know, of one region of Christendom and applying it across all of it. That's just not true, right? So, yeah, I mean, were there areas where there was heresy that was rampant, that was posing significant problems for the church and for secular authority? Absolutely. And that was dealt with. And one of the things I think that, you know, we've talked about trying to understand the worldview of people who lived in a time that was so different from ours, heresy is the exact, you know, point on which to really focus on that. Because heresy for those living in the medieval period was not only just a spiritual matter, but it was also a secular concern as well. Because secular rulers were concerned about the peace and security of those who lived in their realms and lived in their lands. And heresy, when you look at it and you study the history of heresy, heresy bred violence, right? It always produced a violent reaction in society, either from people attacking the heretics or heretics attacking, you know, the people and believers. And so a secular lord was very concerned to ensure there was peace and stability in his land. And so there was a secular punishment for heresy, which was death, frankly. And then there was also a spiritual punishment for heresy, which was excommunication, and which was then maybe a visit by the papal inquisitors who would come and try to teach you the authentic faith and give you an opportunity to repent and to revert and to come back into the fold of the church. And the spiritual aspect also the church was concerned about, frankly, was, you know, one's eternal soul, one's eternal status. Embracing heresy and the allowance of heresy to spread in a region placed, you know, the populace placed their souls in jeopardy. And that was a very real thing for people in the Middle Ages, and it is for believers today, as it should be for most people, frankly, today.
Well, that points to something. You said that peace and stability, that the secular ruler would be concerned about upsets to peace and stability. This, too, I think, is one of the ways in which we modern people really struggle to put ourselves in the mindset of a Christian person of the Middle Ages, in that they believed that all the important stuff happened after you died. If you please correct me if I'm wrong about what I'm about to say, but they didn't put peace and stability would have been important to them in a way that it may not be to us, because we worry a lot about social progress and making progress so that the world becomes this, you know, closer and closer to perfection each year. You know, we want to, but for them, they wanted a peaceful and stable world in which people's salvation could be worked out, because all the important stuff was going to happen after you died.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think you summed that up very well. It's so true, right? The worldview of people living in the Middle Ages was so rooted in the church and rooted in faith, as we've been talking about, that for them, what was important was your eternity, what happened afterwards. And you know, obviously, they believed, as we believe today still, right, that what you do in this life has an impact on what happens in the next. But the next is what's important. And we live in an age, you know, the postmodern age, if you will, where we are so focused, you know, as you put it, on social progress, or we're so focused on temporal concerns, that we have in many ways, frankly, lost the understanding of the importance of what happens after, of the last things, of what is the state of our soul and where we're going to live for eternity, if you will.
And so that affects how we think about the order of society, where we think, well, you know, like this, like free expression, for example, we would basically allow the destruction of our society just so that, you know, people could have free expression of things like pornography or violence or whatever, because we value this world more than the next world. We can't imagine a world that says, no, some things shouldn't be said, some things shouldn't be shown, and some beliefs should be said no to.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's why, you know, people in the modern world struggle so much when we talk about this time period of heresy and of these, as I mentioned, papally appointed inquisitors. And, you know, it's after this period of time that to see the creation of what are known as the institutional tribunals, right? The actual inquisitions, like the Spanish Inquisition and those kinds of things. You know, that's that for us, we look at that. We look at Europe or and the church, you know, with this kind of process of investigating heresy and of trying to ensure that people believed authentically in order that they can live authentically in eternity. You know, we just recoil at that, because we have no comprehension, right, we have very little appreciation for, you know, the fullness of truth and of objective truth and of an understanding that, yeah, again, how we act and how we believe impacts our eternity. Instead, we're focused on, as you point, you know, of ensuring that everyone has the freedom to say this or to say that or believe this or believe that. And that's completely anathema to people in the Middle Ages. ages. They had no understanding of that. And it wasn't because just one point on that is it's not because they were ignorant. It's not because they were stupid. It's not because they were superstitious or zealots or things like that, as many people in the modern world think. You know, we tend, again, have a negative view of this period of time. But rather, it's because of what they valued, right, of how they understood life and how their society was organized and structured, and what they placed value in. They placed value in eternity, and that's something that we in the modern world tend to shortchange.
When we come back from the next break we have to take, I want to ask you about some of your favorite people, because you do cover a good number of people, and Francis and Dominic and Catherine of Siena and Thomas Aquinas and so many of other great people of the Middle Ages. Before we go to the break, however, I would like you to address one thing while we're talking about misconceptions. I don't know if this is a misconception or what it is. I mean, I would just like you to tell me something about the treatment of Jewish people in Christendom in this Middle Ages period, because I think a lot of people would just assume, well, it was just a horror show, the treatment of Jews in the Christian Middle Ages.
Yeah, exactly. That's not entirely true, right? It was a mixed bag is the best way to put that, right? There were times when sadly Jewish people were attacked for being Jewish. And we see this, after the calling of the First Crusade around the Rhineland area, there was one nobleman who went around with a band of followers attacking and killing Jewish people in cities all up and down the Rhine. Now, again, wasn't sponsored by the church. He wasn't told to do that by the church. Is something he did on his own, but he generated a bunch of support, sadly, for it, and it occurred again even after that period and in the calling of the Second Crusade and what happened after that as well. Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, for example, had to personally go and rebuke a fellow Cistercian monk who was spewing anti-Semitic diatribes in the Rhineland, but he did. He put him down and shut him down and told him to go back to the monastery, which he did. But so there were periods and places within Europe and Christendom where there was anti-Semitic behavior, sadly, and pogroms that arise at times. But there were also periods and areas where Jews were accepted just as obviously they were known and seen as being different. They were a minority in a majority Christian area and territories, and so there was a distinction there. The merchant activity in which they engaged in different than Christians as well, so that separated them. So there's a lot of things that the society had that separated Jews and Muslims in Spain in particular from Christians. But in many ways, they were left alone and were valued members of society, valued members of the town and the city. And for example, in Avignon in the south of France, when the popes lived there in the 13th century, the 14th century rather, they protected the Jewish community in Avignon, made sure that they were treated fairly. And when there was a myth when there was a rumor that went around when you had the rise of the Black Death in the middle part of the 14th century that the Jews had started the Black Death, the Pope at the time issued a papal bull that, disavowed that, said that's not true at all, and actually laid the penalty of excommunication on any Christian who abused a Jew because of that, right? Because of that belief or that thought. So the papacy even protected the Jewish people during that time as well. So it's a mixed bag. I mean, but again, one of those things that the individual actions or individual sinful actions of some Christians does not equate to the teaching of the church, right? And some people always conflate those two and confuse those two and think, oh, well, Jews were harassed at times in medieval Christian Europe. Therefore, the church was, complicit in that. And that's just not true.
And there is, there's a kind of a basic testimony in that you can find very large, prosperous, flourishing Jewish communities far flung across all of Europe, even far into Northern Europe.
Yeah, that's very true. And there were places, in France, England, where the Jewish people were expelled by secular rulers. So, there was a dispersion of them as well, sure. But then, they are, throughout the Middle Ages, frankly, by secular rulers, expelled. And so then they find refuge in other areas, especially in Spain, frankly, up until at least the 15th century.
This is one of these areas where it's very helpful to have a historian who will tell you the story, warts and all, because it's clear from what you're saying there are warts in this regard, that we can't look back and just go, oh, come on, the Jews had it great in the Middle Ages. But nuance is required here, and I appreciate that from you, Steve Weidenkopf. We always get that from you. And Steve's brand new book is called The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. Let's take a look at some of the great figures of that period when we come back with Steve.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to Catholic radio. It's perfect. It provides peace and it builds us up and strengthens us. We listen to it whenever we're in the car. My husband and I love it. He got me started with it before he even became a Catholic. He owns his own business, and so he's working by himself, and he listens to Catholic radio. He's called in several times too. It's using the technology that we have for good.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As the end of the year approaches, oh, I'm sure there'll be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth as 2020 goes out. So many people regretting the passing of such a fine year. But we'll do our best. We'll muddle through. Maybe 2021 will provide a greater entertainment than 2020 did. A little bit of a rough year. I'm not giving out our number because we're just having a conversation with Steve Weidenkopf about his brand new book on the Middle Ages. Steve is a lecturer in history at the Christendom College Graduate School of Theology. And the new book, he's got a whole bunch of books, and you can find all of his books over at steveweidenkopf.com or at amazon.com or all over the internet. But the newest book came out on Christmas Day, or the release date was Christmas Day, The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. So we've talked a bit about, you know, in broad general terms about this period of the Middle Ages, but I think the way to end is on some of the personalities, because I have to say, you just say a few names from the 13th century, you know, Francis and Dominic and Thomas and Catherine, and you think this is possibly the greatest century in the history of the world. I mean, a century that can produce characters like that is a time of tremendous. Just to be able to do that, it says something wonderful about that era.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's you know, the historian Warren Carroll, who founded Christendom College where I teach at, he termed this period of time that we're talking about the glory of Christendom, right? The glory of, yeah, of this period. I mean, and that's true. I mean, that's really, there is such a gloriousness about it. Yeah. Although we've talked about it, there's, you know, warts in it as well. So it's not like everything was perfect and everybody was a walking saint. But, you know, it was a period of just intense, you know, powerful activity, you know, in the realm of faith, in the realm of, you know, military and politics, lots of things going on here, lots of great personages, as you mentioned, Francis, Dominic, Thomas, you know, Albert, others. But even before them, there were some great people, and I cover them in my book in this little section that we call Up Close and Personal, where we talk about, I highlight a few different figures of the of this period of time that I'm talking about in my book. And one of them is Abbot Suger of Saint-Denis. And for anybody who's been to Paris and been north of Paris into the Church of Saint, the Abbey Church of Saint Denis there. It's a beautiful church that is the traditional burial place of the kings of France. And so you can walk through the church and still today and see, you know, the tombs of so many different French kings and just, you know, all these important people of history, you know, that are buried there. It's quite fantastic place. And Suger was responsible for building that, right? He was the one who really is credited with starting the kind of, you know, the beginnings of the Gothic architectural style, right? That the vaulted ceilings, the high mirrors, the rose windows, the, you know, the ultimately would be the flying buttresses and things outside to support the high walls with the windows. And just he's, you know, we talked about earlier about someone being able to rise through the ranks, if you will, of the church, regardless of where you came from. Suger was the son of a serf. He came from very poor background. But he rose to become an abbot. He rose to become regent, frankly, of the Kingdom of France. When King Louis VII went on the Second Crusade in the middle part of the 12th century, he appointed Suger to be regent. So he acted, in essence, as king while the king was gone for a number of years on the crusade. This is the son of a serf, right? Amazing how he was able to do that. But a man of great faith, of great intelligence, and one who, you know, had a great – his faith moved him to beauty and the expression of beauty in this architectural style with this church. So if any listener has an opportunity to go into Paris, north of Paris, especially hopefully in 2021 when things are hopefully back to normal, we can travel a bit better. Definitely you have to see the Abbey Church of Saint-Denis. It's beautiful.
This is another great thing, is that right into the modern era, many of the institutions and the buildings, they still survive. It's amazing to think of, you know, in this period that you write about, I believe that's the beginning of the English Parliament and the beginning of the University of Paris, and now called the Sorbonne, I think. But there are institutions in the modern world that trace their time back to here, back to these years.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's there's a great quote I have in the book from G.K. Chesterton. He makes that point, right, that so often, even in his time, right, that so often earlier in the 20th century, so often people thought of the Middle Ages or medieval as something brutish and nasty and bloody, as we've talked about. But then he notes, he says, people forget that, you know, parliaments are medieval, that universities are medieval, that many of the things that we you know, like about the modern world, or that we find, good about the modern world, were created during this period of time, you know, and we're standing on the shoulders of those who've come before us, you know, who created those things for us. So it's beautiful. Yeah.
Any other figures you want to, I mean, persons, people who lived in that period that you want to commend to us?
Oh yeah, I really love Godfrey de Bouillon too. I mean, I try to highlight in the book not just saints. So we talked about Suger, not a saint, but a churchman. I also try to bring up, you know, lay people who were not saints, and Godfrey de Bouillon is one of them. And Godfrey was one of the major crusade leaders on the First Crusade. He was from what is now, you know, German territory, Alsace Lorraine, French territory too, and he was just a warrior that was imbued with a love of God and a love of the church, and went on crusade and participated in that armed pilgrimage because of that. You know, he cared for his men. He led by example. He was in the thick of all the fighting and the battle. He wasn't we would call it a rear guard commander, right, of military forces. He led from the front. You know, one of the beautiful things I like about Godfrey is at the end of the First Crusade, which was successful, they liberated the holy city of Jerusalem. You know, they wanted to, they had to protect the territory that they had liberated, so they decided to create a kingdom, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, a feudal territory, and they were going to appoint a king. And one of the other crusade leaders who went, Count Raymond of Toulouse, he really wanted to be king, but he didn't want to be seen as wanting to be king. If you get the drift, right? So I want to be king, but sure, I don't want to look like I'm you know. Politicking for it, if you will. Right. So the other leaders asked him and said, "You want to be king?" to Count Raymond. And he said, no, I really don't," hoping that they would say, "Oh, please. But when he said no, they said, "Okay." And then they went to somebody else. They went to Godfrey and said, "Do you want to be king?" And he said, "No, I'm not. I won't be king. But I will, you know, be the feudal protector, if you will, of the city of Jerusalem." And so he took the title Defender of the Holy Sepulchre, right? Defender of the Church of Jerusalem, which was the point. And, you know, small T tradition holds that he said, apocryphal story, but it's apt in keeping with his character. Godfrey said, I refuse to take a crown of gold in the city where my Savior wore a crown of thorns. And that really exhibits, right? And again, that's probably apocryphal. He may not have ever said it, but it really bespeaks of who he really was and the mindset that he had and how he approached life, which is emblematic of people in the Middle Ages anyways.
Wonderful. I love the choices. Thank you very much for sharing them. I know you have many, many more, and they're in the book. So I'm just recommend to people again. Before you forget, get this book. You're just going to be so happy that you did. And knowing medieval history, even a little bit, gives you a greater a grounding in the real world. Just go to you can go wherever good Catholic books are sold and get The Church and the Middle Ages, Cathedrals, Crusades, and the Papacy in Exile. Steve Weidenkopf is the author. Steve, thanks. I really appreciate you taking the hour to help us remember such an important time.
My pleasure, Si. Thanks again so much. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And we'll hope for a good one in 2021 when we can all go and visit Saint-Denis in just outside of Paris. We're right back after this with more Catholic Answers Live.